London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
I don't think Robert would mind if I nick his music, will he? Will he mind? Don't tell him. Don't tell him and he'll never know. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee. Bye, Nicky. Bye-bye. Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, filling in for Robert just for one day. Don't panic, guys. Don't panic. And it's the same old, same old. I ain't changing a thing today, so don't panic. Busy show. Busy show. Later on, we've got Tia Gilmore coming in. And oh, how much I dislike talented people who are younger than me. She's younger than me. She's had about 15 albums out already. Did you see that? She's coming in to play live, which will be delightful. Jerry Cottle Jr. is founder of the Rooftop Cinema. It is what you'd guess it would be. But now they're doing an underground cinema. And then, just after one... we've got this woman called Lucy Fry coming in, okay, who's written this book, which I'm holding in my hands, Run, Ride, Sink or Swim. It's got a very deceptive subheading, A Year in the Exhilarating and Addictive World of Women's Triathlon. I can't think of anything less addictive than triathlon. She writes about it brilliantly. It's a cracking read. She just decided she wanted to do 5 triathlons in a year, so she went and did it. I'm a very, very lazy man. So when she comes in, I'm going to give her... I've got some stern questions for her. But before that as well, I mean, it's notes and queries. I filled in for Robert a couple of times. I always feel rather humbled coming in and doing notes and queries because, well, it's notes and queries, for crying out loud. You know it better than I do. There's something that you've seen, you've heard, you've smelt, you've touched. Something in London that's left you scratching your head going, well, how did that get there? Or why would they have put that there? Or hang on, but why is that called that? Get in touch now. I've been told it gets very, very busy. So... 81333 is the text. Start your text line. You know all of this more than I do. 0207-224-2000. 0207-224-2000. You can email me today. We're going to use my email. Ian.lee, I-A-I-N, .L-E-E, at bbc.co.uk. I want some good ones today, and I'm hoping I can answer them. I want to look dead clever, but it's very, very, it's very unlikely I will. Bit of Steve Harley, is it? Yes. I mean, there are very few songs which are perfect. That song's perfect, isn't it? That's a perfect song. I'm trying to think of other perfect songs. Daydream Believer by the Monkees. That's a perfect song. Let It Be by the Beatles, is that a perfect song? It's Notes and Queries Day today. Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, filling in for Robert. Notes and Queries is carrying on. We need your calls and your texts and, well, ideally your calls, because it's good to for me to kind of question you about what you've seen or what you've heard or what you want to... What's got you scratching your head in London? And, I've been on a Beatles trip this week. Not literally, I mean, I've been into the... I went and saw Paul McCartney live on Sunday. Two-thirds of that concert was excellent. One-third was rubbish. I mean, I know. He did so many new songs. And when he says, here's one, you know, for my wife, Nancy. I wrote it. It's called My Valentine. You think, oh, blimey. Paul McCartney doing a song called My Valentine. It was a stinker. It was a stinker. But two-thirds of that concert was fantastic. And bizarrely, earlier in the day, I'd also seen a Beatles tribute band. My wife had said, oh, there's a Beatles tribute band playing around the corner. Do you want to go and see it? I was like, yeah. So I'm kind of got a Beatles vibe going on. And I've got a question. Am I allowed to do a question for Notes and Queries? I'm going to do it. I don't care. I don't care what the rules are. You know when the Beatles played on top of Apple... which I think, was it number one, Savile Row? Is that where Apple was? On 1969, for the Let It Be film. Right. First of all, if anyone saw that rooftop concert, 0207-224-2000, I want to speak to you. But also, if you were on the ground, if you were in the street, if you were in Savile Row or the surrounding areas, would you have seen anything? Because in the film, if you've seen the film Let It Be, which is wonderful if you want to watch four friends disintegrating, there are loads of people on roofs, on other buildings that are kind of parallel with it. And they obviously, they can see the Beatles performing. But if you were in the street, you wouldn't have seen anything, because they weren't kind of leaning over the edge. I know, it's a long shot. A lot of these are on those queries. They're long shots. Were you at the Beatles rooftop concert? Were you on the ground? Could you see anything? I'm going to throw that out there and leave that with you. 0207 224 2000. And could you hear? Was it recognisable what they were playing? Because it's a tall building. And it was quite a horrible cold day. They're all wearing Macintosh coats and things. Thick fur coat, I think George has got on, or one of them's got on. I can't remember. 0207 224 2000. The Beatles' Let It Be rooftop gig. Did you see it, hear it? Was there anything you could see or hear? Or was it just that thing? It's that thing, isn't it? If there are people stood in the street looking up, you'll join them. You go, oh, must be something happening here. I'll look up. And you could be there for ages before you go, I don't think there's anything there. I think we've all been duped. 0207 224 2000. That's my hijacking of notes and queries. But, of course, no, it's all about you, dear listener. What questions have got you scratching your head about London? And we've got Lucy Fry coming in an hour, and her book is kind of... it's fascinating, Mira. She's quite a fit person anyway. She's a personal trainer and she writes about fitness. She then decided to do a triathlon, okay? And I've read most of the book, not all of it, but I've read it. And it's left me scratching my head. I don't get it. And there's a big triathlon happening this weekend. It's Hyde Park, it's happening. I don't get it. I do not. It sounds absolutely horrendous. If you've done a triathlon, can you tell? Triathlon, it turns out, is the same as the Ironman challenge as well. It's the same event. It's just a kind of like a brand. Ironman is the brand name, I think. If you've done it, can you tell me why? What did you get out of it? And what was the thought process that made you go, do you know what? I'm going to put myself through absolute hell. I'm going to swim a massive distance, then get out of the river and cycle for hours, soaking wet, and then run. What? I just literally cannot comprehend it. There you go. That's plenty to sink your teeth into. Why on earth would anyone do a triathlon? Beatles rooftop concert. Were you there? And your notes and queries, please. 0207 224 2000. You know that's what I like. Love with affection. There's not enough songs with, here it comes, him. There's not enough song with the deep voice bass man singing. You know that's what I like. Him! There's not enough songs with a bass man. Does that, doesn't it? I can't think of any, apart from 50s doo-wop to one side. Vic, can you think of any more songs with a bass man going?
Yeah, Temptations.
Which Temptations? Did they do it a lot of theirs?
Yeah, Papa Was a Rolling Stone.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, Vic, you're absolutely spot on. It's a great, there doesn't seem to be that much call for the bass man anymore. You can't imagine Miley Cyrus or Coldplay employing a bass man to... It's a shame, it's a dying skill.
I'm a soul man anyway, so...
Do you know what, Vic? It's interesting you say that. I am a white pop guy, okay? I like kind of 60s Monkees, Beach Boys, Beatles, XTC. I like that kind of pop. I'm just starting to get into the Northern Soul.
Yeah, you've got to. It's great.
Well, it's brilliant, isn't it? But I don't know anything about it.
Did you see the film?
No, I've not. I've not seen the film. I saw a documentary a little while ago, and that's kind of opened the doors a bit. But though is the film any good?
Yeah, the film's great. There's a documentary out about it as well. I can't remember that. If you go, someone will know about it.
Someone will know about it. I hope. Yeah. But this, the thing is, it's like saying, oh, I'm just getting into Northern Soul. It's like saying, oh, I'm just going to get into classical music. It's such a big, broad thing. I wouldn't have a clue where to start.
Well, it's a second generation, third generation thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, all the stuff that never really made it in the 60s, it's an incredible story. Didn't make it in the 60s, and then it kind of got bought up by a few geeks, and got, you know, late 60s, early 70s, and people travelled from all over the country, from London, from everywhere, to go and dance to it.
Nobody knew nothing about it in London.
When did it hit London, then? Sort of mid-70s?
I would say mid-70s, yeah. Second generation.
Well, Vic, thanks for calling. That's not what you've called in about, but I appreciate it. By the way, any songs with Bassmen on 81333, start your text London. Vic, what have you got for us?
I've got a fella in Kings Road, Chelsea.
Yep.
He walks from Sloane Square all the way down to Kings Road towards the Chelsea Football Club area. And he must be a Chelsea supporter because he walks down the road with two great big parrots. And I mean big parrots. They're dressed in blue and yellow.
Huh?
And we want to know all about him. We want to know who he is, what he does, where he goes, with the parrots on his shoulders.
So, right, are they alive, these parrots?
Oh, they're alive, all right, yeah. They're great big McCoys, great big things.
And where is this? This is in Chelsea?
Yeah, Sloane Square. He congregates around Sloane Square, and he just gets people to take photographs of him and everything. And he walks up and down King's Road. He's been doing it for a while. I've been driving a few years in my cab, and I've seen him for the last 10 years.
Really? Because I've been to Sloane Square a few times. I've never come across... 0207-224-2000, if you can. I've never come across the parrot-wearing gentleman.
You'll see him. He's got to go there, you know, maybe early in the morning, you know.
I imagine, Vic, that parrots have the ability to be quite vicious.
Well, these two are quite tame.
But parrots look... It's because they, you know, they're colourful and they're green and they're red and they're whatever. They look like they're quite nice, but they're massive birds, aren't they?
Yeah, these are great big McCoy. They must be pretty big birds. I mean, they just perch on his shoulder and he walks down the road with them. It's unbelievable.
You've reminded me... Well, I used to live in Crouch End in North London, and there was a gentleman that would walk around Crouch End dressed up like, like a cavalier. He had the big wide-brimmed hat, the big moustache, the kind of ruffled shirt, the kind of knee-length leather boots with the fold-overs. And he was always... Yeah. And the first time you see him, you think, oh, he's off to, like, a fete or a May Day fair or something. No. He'd be coming out of Waitrose with his shopping dress like that.
I know. Listen, young man, I'm dropping off now.
Thank you, Vic.
I've got to help the people out of cab.
Good lad. Thank you, Vic. Keep up the good work. And Vic, anyone that calls me young man, well, very, very welcome as far as I'm concerned. 0207-224-2000. Wayne's in Buckhurst Hill. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Good afternoon.
What have you got for us, fella?
Well, you were talking about the Beatles.
Yes.
I remember them on the roof, but that's not the question.
Okay. Hang on a second. We'll get to the question in a second.
I was working in Regent Street at the time.
Yeah.
And everything went quiet. And wondered what was going on.
Yeah.
You could hear the noise above the above their place in Savile Row.
Wow.
And crowds appeared all along the floor. You could hardly hear. I mean, you just heard noise. But I remember it quite well. Not that I'm a Beatles fan.
No, well, this is the thing. I suspect most people, because by that end, at that point, it was kind of the end of the Beatles, you know. And could you see them?
Yeah, if you stood in Burlington Gardens, which is the end of Savile Row, near the Royal Academy, and you looked up, you could see movements.
But you didn't know. At what point did you realise it was the Beatles? Was it someone went, it's the Beatles, that is?
The mouth, all going around.
Isn't that
Everybody
funny?
Everybody came out, the shops came out, the offices, all to see it.
And was the buzz, this is exciting, those Beatles are doing it again, or was it, oh, for goodness sakes, get your hair cut and shut up?
No, I think most people, because they never appeared live for years, I think most people just wanted to know what was going on, what it was. I mean, they obviously knew that it was the Apple's offices in Savile Row, but, you know, you could hear a blur in the background or a tinny noise in the background, and it was crowded all the way from, you know, where Regent Street meets Burlington Gardens, all the way up Savile Row, and, it was packed. Everybody came out the shops. Anyway...
go on, that's not what you've called in about, though, is it? What have you got for us?
Everyone of a certain age remembers the Apple shop in Baker Street, which didn't last long. Anyway, I remember that there was another Apple shop in the King's Road.
Oh. Because they had the boutique, didn't they? Where it was all psychedelic designs by The Fool, I think, and it was all it was a massive flop. But there was another shop, was there?
Yeah, I remember another shop that specialised, well, it was all ready-to-wear clothes, and I remember another shop in the King's Road called Apple Tailoring.
Right.
I think it was owned at the time by a guy called John Crittle, who used to kind of personally dress them.
Yeah.
Can somebody tell me about it? Because it never gets any kind of notoriety.
Where was this again? This Apple Tailoring?
King's Road.
Okay.
In the King's Road.
We're all around there today.
I can't remember, you know, exactly where it was. Maybe somebody can help.
And it was called Apple. It was called Apple Tailoring, was it?
Well, it was called. I remember seeing the sign. It was called Apple Tailoring.
Yeah.
And I remember that there was like a hairdressing shop downstairs.
And it was definitely Apple, as in the Beatles Apple.
Definitely Apple.
God, I've never heard of this.
It was called Apple Tailoring.
Yep.
And I remember outside it was called John Crittle.
Okay.
And it must have had something to do with the Beatles, because John Crittle kind of dressed them.
Wayne, listen, it's out there. It's in the ether. If anybody knows, you lot will know. 0207-224-2000. I'm pretty hot on Beatles history. I've not heard of that. A Beatles tailoring shop, Apple Tailoring. Well, there we go. It's out there. So what have we got so far? There's a cracking start. Thank you, Vic. Thank you, Wayne. So we've got a fella that walks around Sloane Square with two parrots on his shoulders. Not seen that. I don't trust parrots. I got the feeling. I bet they're vicious. They look nice, but if you rub them up the wrong way, they'd have you, wouldn't they? And we've got Wayne asking about the Beatles tailoring, Apple Tailoring in the King's Road. 0207-224-2000 is the telephone number. You can text 81333, start your text London, or you can email me, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. I'm sitting in for Robert Elms. Notes and queries, we've got some cracking ones. The Apple Tailoring store on the King's Road linked to the Beatles. I've never heard of that. Just when you think you know everything about the Beatles, you get that. And the parrot man in the Chelsea area, Sloane Square, walks around. He's got two parrots on his shoulders. It sounds like the start of a very bad joke, doesn't it? 0207-224-2000, if you can answer those. Also, we've still got room for a few more questions. If you've got any questions or queries or something that leaves you scratching your head about London, then give us a call. We're going to go arts and culture in a bit. I know, fancy, isn't it? Very fancy. Afternoon, BBC London 94.9. This is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms. Notes and queries kind of rumbles away underneath the show while we're talking about other bits and pieces. You can call in 0207-224-2000. We're going to be talking as well about, well, I'm speaking to someone who's done. It was squeaky, wasn't it? I can see you now, Alice. You see, the screen was in the way. I thought, oh, I'll subtly move down that screen and there's nothing.
With sound effects.
There's nothing.
Which naturally you'd rehearsed earlier.
That's the squeakiest.
Entirely intentional.
That's the squeakiest computer monitor I've ever heard in my life. We're going to be speaking later on to Lucy Fry, who's, well, she's a triathlete. Alice, would you ever consider doing a triathlon?
I would not, because
no.
I wouldn't be able to do it, but immense respect for Lucy Fry and other triathletes for
I'm not sure I even have respect. I just think they need to be sat down and have a good work speaking to. Why would you do such a thing?
No, I think it's brilliant.
It is brilliant. And she's coming in later on. She's written a cracking book, Run, Ride, Sink or Swim, which we'll talk about later. But Alice Rawsthorne is here. You are the arts and the culture expert. It says expert here.
Well, if only. I think that is a bit of an exaggeration, but never mind. I'll take it.
Now, the first one you've got is one of my favourite places in London. And it's kind of, it's not as secret as perhaps it once was, the John Soane Museum. It's still one of those things that's kind of hidden away a little bit, isn't it?
It is, though when I went on Saturday, there was a queue of people waiting outside.
Was there
to
really?
In.
Oh, well, part of me thinks good, and part of me thinks, oh, darn.
Indeed, but
they
that's
found
partly
it.
Because they don't want too many people to go in at the same time, because it would spoil it. But for listeners who haven't been there, the most important thing to say is go as quickly as possible.
Oh, it's tiny as well. That's why they're a big queue, because it's all tiny and cramped
indeed.
And wonderful.
And it is or was the home and also the offices of one of the greatest British architects in history, John Soane. Mm. And he was the sort of dominant British architect of the late 18th and early 19th century when neoclassicism was very fashionable. This was when architects and artists were inspired by their sort of visions of the antiquities of ancient Greece and Rome. And Soane was absolutely the master of the neoclassical style. So he designed and built some really extraordinary buildings from the whole of the Bank of England, for which he was chief architect for many decades.
Gosh.
And that really was his masterpiece, insanely, and I cannot overstate that too much. The Bank of England demolished almost everything John Soane designed for them, other than a corner facade.
Oh, that's nice. They kept a corner facade. Oh, that's
did.
So generous.
In the 1920s, and of course replaced it with a deeply mediocre building. So one of the saddest parts of the Soane Museum are he worked very closely with an architectural draftsman called Joseph Gandy, who did brilliant drawings of all his buildings, but particularly the Bank of England, including this amazing fantasy of the Bank of England in ruins, which cleverly also shows the sort of workings of the Bank of England and all the very intelligent structural interventions Soane had made, but sort of horribly prophesied what would happen to his design. So the Soane Museum has been open to the public for many, many years, ever since John Soane's death, in fact. The reason to go now is that a new floor has been restored, and these are the Soane family's private apartments.
Gosh.
So they're the rooms where Soane not really lived with his wife Eliza, but certainly slept, they ate there, they bathed there, and so on. So first of all, the museum actually consists of three houses on Lincoln's Inn Fields, which is a beautiful part of central London, which you're right, people generally don't go to because it's sort of between Covent Garden and Lincoln's Inn, the Inn of Court. And so it's really one of the loveliest squares in central London.
It's dead quiet there. It's dead quiet. It's kind of, you know, in between the hubbub of London. And
exactly.
It's just nice and peaceful. And
another excellent reason for going to the Soane Museum is that you see it as the wealthy residents of Lincoln's Inn Fields would have seen it in the 18th and 19th centuries. You see the top of the trees as you go higher up the house. It's really
lovely. Inside, that's not, he didn't live with it like that. Did he?
Yes.
With all of that clutter and all those everything there.
So Soane, he bought one of the houses, first of all, which is the sort of simplest of the three. And Scrimpton saved, unusually for an architect, particularly at the, in that period, he came from a working class family. His father was a bricklayer. Mm. He was so talented, he won a scholarship to the Royal Academy schools, and the architecture schools were then in Somerset House. And flourished very early on in his career because he really was so extraordinarily talented. And like many artists and architects and intellectuals of the time, he went on a grand tour of Italy and Greece. And as he became more successful and wealthier, he would come back with sort of relics of the grand tour, so souvenirs. So it would be a sort of chunk of an ancient column.
And it's full of all this stuff. It's kind of like the equivalent, I guess, of bringing back a giant wicker donkey or the
exactly.
big hat. It's that kind
the
of thing, isn't it?
The difference being, however, Soane did use these ancient remains as inspiration for his designs, for his buildings. And he taught at the Royal Academy schools, at the architecture school in Somerset House for many years. So before and after his lectures, his students were invited to Lincoln's Inn Field to come and study as well. He was also a passionate book collector.
Yeah.
And Eliza, his wife, who shared all his enthusiasms, I mean, they seemed to be a very happy couple and certainly were both dedicated to fostering Soane's glittering career. And he was constantly acquiring paintings, books, antique relics, and it was actually Eliza who did the buying for him. So she would negotiate with the auctioneers, she'd go to the sales and clinch the deal for him, so they were very much a team.
You go in there now and it does look like those, you know, you get those documentaries on Channel 5 about super hoarders where the people have it's kind of
Soane
like that
was a super hoarder, and actually that is why the house became a museum and was given to the public, because Soane's original plan was that their sons, John and George, would take over his architectural practice and he would thereby found an architectural dynasty. Sadly, because things never ever work out that way, they turned out to be A, talentless, and B... rather rakish and dissipated.
Oh, dear.
So he was estranged from them.
Oh, dear.
Late in life. Yeah. And he and Eliza were under no illusions at all that they would flog off their painstakingly acquired collections in order to fund their increasingly decadent.
So they didn't want the boys to get their hands on
it. They didn't want the boys to get their hands on it. Now, tragically, Eliza died in 1815. And Soane died in 1837. Mm. So he carried on without her for many years. But he continued the collections, and more of that later. But he negotiated with the government to donate all three houses and their contents to the nation to be used for sort of education and research. I think at the time he probably envisaged that students and scholars would go to study the collection rather than the hoi polloi like you and me marching in and out.
No, the Japanese tourists.
This
is
cluttered, but it's really amazing. So there was an act of parliament to accept the collection for the nation, and he donated it on condition that everything had to remain in the same place,
wow,
in the same condition as when he died. So in the final years of his life, he was constantly adding to the collection and zhuzhing it about and rearranging it. But in the final years of his life, he had his goal in sight. And he and Eliza had lived on the second floor. They'd both had a bedroom there. They had a bathroom there. Yeah. And they had Eliza's morning room, where she would sort of do her correspondence and they'd sort of sit and chat and presumably plan their next acquisitions together. They actually had a breakfast room and a dining room in another part of the house, and would use the library and the drawing room for public entertaining. But all of that was very professional. So these were really their personal rooms. And when the collection was donated to the nation, the curator of the collection moved in and converted this private floor into an office and a rather handy central London flat.
Yeah, I'll take the job of curator. Can I live there, please? That's a little bit sneaky.
But there has now, as part of the restoration of the Soane Museum, it has now been converted back to the private apartments, and they are absolutely fantastic. I mean, I don't think we have stressed enough how wonderful the Soane Museum is.
Oh, it's incredible.
Cluttered though it is like stepping back into another world.
You're going back in time. You're actually going back in time.
He has he built the house to accommodate the collections. Mm. So there's a whole area of it where literally there's a sort of cavity in several floors of the house. So you see up and down for where these amazing sort of antique remains
are positioned. It's an incredible place. And you're right. I've been there when there's been a queue there. But it's worth the wait because they don't let that many people in at one go.
Exactly, because they might damage the contents. But, you know, there's even a mummified cat because he was obsessed by many things, and ancient Egyptian remains were one, and in the pyramids apparently mummified cats would be buried by
the Egyptians. Love
people
the cats,
who built them. Exactly, and so that continued to be a sort of ritual for architects and builders for many centuries. So anyway, the apartments have been converted back to how they were when Soane and Eliza lived there, and so Eliza's morning room is more or less intact, because for many years after her death he refused to touch anything in her rooms. He just left them, which is sort of rather sad and touching,
isn't it? Yeah.
So he was hoping she'd return. And so there is a Rubens drawing of a dog, which looks like a sort of affectionate family pet, which they must have bought at an auction. There are Turners there.
Wow.
There are beautiful architectural drawings by Joseph Gandhi, the draftsman with whom Soane worked. But in Eliza's bedroom, towards the end of his life, he obviously felt he was running out of space for his architectural models in the rest of the house, so he decided to convert it into a model room. Mm. So, and this is the biggest room on the floor. I mean, if it was a flat, and a lot of those buildings will have been converted into flats, it would be a rather lovely and spacious living room. And Soane acquired a massive cork model of Pompeii, obviously after...
A cork model of Pompeii?
Of Pompeii, obviously after...
That's the kind of thing I'd come home from a car boot sale with. My wife would say, what the hell are you going to do with that?
I don't think you would, because you wouldn't fit it in your car.
Oh, is it massive?
It is absolutely enormous. So he designed this special sort of neoclassical massive...
Yeah.
Sort of stand for it to go on, and then put many other models around it. And of course, he would buy models from, you know, the finest model maker in the world, who was then a model maker in Paris, who'd do these incredibly detailed, I mean, if they were produced now, you'd think they were 3D printed. They're so intricate. Amazing models of the Parthenon and other famous buildings. So it is an absolutely incredible room. And again, Soane intended that favoured students would come and look at it. You also see his bed, his bath, and so on. So it's a wonderful glimpse of the way a really intelligent, culturally sophisticated, enlightened, but endlessly curious man like Soane lived privately.
So that's the Soane Museum.
That's the Soane Museum. But the restoration of the museum continues, and thrillingly, in the basement, Soane's catacombs are currently being restored,
and
they should be open next year. Okay. So there are more things to see. Now, at the moment, you can only go to the Soane apartments on guided tours.
Right.
And they're at certain times of the day, around lunchtime. They're free. You have to book online. So if you go to the Soane Museum website, which is Soane, S-O-A-N-E .org, then you can book your private tour.
Alice, listen, I'm going to play a song.
Go ahead.
Then we're going to... I know you've got two more. We're going to do our best to squeeze both of them in. Hang on a second. Here's The Clash. Afternoon, Ian Lee, BBC London, 94.9. Alice Rawsthorne is here. What have we've got? We've only got about 5-6 minutes. What have you got for us?
Well, very quickly, a couple of other interesting exhibitions at the moment. First of all, the Photographer's Gallery, which is very near here.
Yep.
It's just south of Oxford Street, near Oxford Circus. And every year they do their version of the Turner Prize, which is the Deutsche Börse Photography Prize. And four international photographers stage an exhibition at the gallery. They've been nominated for photography exhibitions all over the world. And the prize is awarded. This year's prize will actually be announced tomorrow, but the exhibition is on for another couple of weeks. And the prize is always a great way of sort of seeing contemporary practice in photography. And so there are four all really interesting, completely different photographers who are nominated this year. The first one is a Russian photographer, Nikolai Bakarev, and he is in his 60s.
Yep.
And he started out as a factory photographer for the Soviet Union. So he was sort of employed as an official propaganda photographer to document Soviet factories. And he began just as a sort of an aside thing to photograph Russian families and couples and groups of friends at their leisure, largely on beaches and in forests. And his photographs are all black and white. He obviously had a sort of winning way with people because some of these people invited him into their homes. So there are amazing photographs of the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s of families all sort of at leisure, enjoying themselves, much as families do all over the world, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, on beaches and in forests. But obviously, given
beaches and forests,
on
that's
life
very specific.
In the Soviet Union,
this
was a way of depicting a private life in a sort of publicly, fiercely scrutinised, very constrained and oppressive regime. They're all black and white. Interestingly, there are a couple of his photographs at the Whitechapel Gallery at the moment in a series, a collection of works assembled by Lynette Yoqui Bodem, the artist, and his work was shown at the Venice Biennale, not the current Art Biennale, the last one 2 years ago. So a very interesting photographer showing the sort of a very super realistic but very private and personal side of the Soviet regime. There is also a South African photographer, a much younger photographer, now in her 40s, Zaneli Muholi, and she has documented the LGBT movement, so lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people living in South Africa. And she has taken a series of very moving black and white portraits. I mean, super simple, but very evocative of their characters, of them, and also made films of them documenting the often terrible lives they've led, dealing with repression and prejudice. So really, this is looking at a struggle for identity, not ethnic identity, but obviously gender identity and sexual preferences in post-apartheid South Africa. So a very moving part of the exhibition.
We've only got 90 seconds left. I know, I'm sorry, I could talk to you all day.
We also have Vivian Sassen, who's a Dutch photographer, much more introspective, almost abstract work, sort of playing with light and shadow. And then another South African photographer, Mikhail Subotsky, and a British photographer, Patrick Waterhouse, who collaboratively photographed Ponte City, which is a sort of derelict apartment building, tower block, that was built during apartheid South Africa and then was abandoned in post-apartheid South Africa, was basically used as a squat by homeless people who were then turfed out so it could be redeveloped, but it was.
It never was.
So, again, very plaintive and moving. The winner will be announced tomorrow, but another couple of weeks to see the exhibition. And while you're at the Photographer's Gallery, do go to a brilliant exhibition there called The China Photo Book. This is an exhibition of Chinese photography books since 1900. So as well as being an amazing study of Chinese photography, which obviously takes in propaganda photography for the cult of Chairman Mao, to the much more expressive and sort of intellectually challenging photography that Chinese artists are producing today through the form of photo books, which has always been a very popular medium in China, but it's also an incredible sort of whistle-stop tour of Chinese history.
Alice, I've got to stop you. I could talk to you for ages. It's fascinating. And what I love is, you not only do you know your stuff, you're so passionate about it as well. Alice, it's so nice to see you again.
Very nice to see you.
I appreciate all of your help and your input.
BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
Thank you, Will. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Don't worry, Rob will be back tomorrow. Don't panic, Mr. Mannering, don't panic. Coming up, we're going to speak to Lucy Fry, who is, bonkers. From what I can gather, she's written a brilliant book. She's going to be in a few minutes to tell us about that. It's also Notes and Queries Day today. My own selfish query was about the Beatles' rooftop concert on the roof of Apple in Savile Row. Did you see it? Was it exciting? Could you see or hear anything? Because they weren't over the edge of the roof. It's a tall building. They're kind of in the middle of the roof. So unless you were on another roof, you wouldn't have seen anything. And did you know what it was? Was there a buzz going around? Oh, it's them Beatles. At this point, they didn't look like the Mop Tops. You know, they all had long hair and were a bit jaded. So maybe you were jaded. If you saw it, 0207 224 2000. From that, we got a question from Wayne about, well, he remembered the Beatles' Apple Boutique, which was the kind of the clothing store. He also says there was an Apple tailoring in the King's Road. And loads of you have emailed me, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. And Graham has, what's Graham? Graham sent me some pictures of it. Now, the pictures, it's going to be hard for me to describe, but it's the front of the shop, civil and theatrical Apple tailoring by John, I can't read what that says there, Brittle or something like that. It looks incredible. And then there's a shot inside and it looks, you know, like proper 60s. and there's John Lennon outside it, looking very gaunt. Did anyone... Okay, so it existed. We know it existed. Okay, and we've got pictures of it inside and out. Did you go in it? Did you go in and have a little look around? Did you get a suit made by Apple Tailoring? Because if you did, that would be worth a fortune, wouldn't it? 0207 224 2000. And the third question we've got, this came from Vic, and it's about the gentleman in the Chelsea area, primarily Sloane Square, who walks around and he's got two parrots, one on either shoulder. Massive parrots, not your tiny ones, massive ones. Any idea who that guy is? And well, why has he got two parrots on his shoulders? 0207 224 2000. I've just looked at Robert's Facebook page. The parrot man was spotted about 15 minutes ago in Mayfair. If you can get him, if you can see him and he looks like he's approachable, could you go and... Well, don't tap him on the shoulder. He's got a parrot on his shoulder. But could you you know, ask him to give us a call. If we can speak to the Parrot Man by the end of the show, that would be fantastic. 0207 224 2000. I'm joined now by Lucy Fry, though, who is, well, he's nuts. Let's be honest. I've been saying it behind your back. I'm going to say it to your face, Lucy. You're nuts. You've written this book, Run, Ride, Sink or Swim. Now, I'll be honest. When I was told you're going to be reading a book called Run, Ride, Sink or Swim with the subtitle A Year in the Exhilarating and Addictive World of Women's Triathlon, part of me went, oh, blimey. I've only read half it, and half a good book. It is a good book. You decided to do 5 triathlons over a year. You're quite fit before, aren't you? I mean, fitness is an important part of your life. It's not as if you're doing this from a point of being a complete couch potato.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But what was the point where you thought, I'm going to do, not just I'm going to do a triathlon, I'm going to do 5 triathlons?
Well, I went swimming with Becky Adlington in the Caribbean, did an open water swim challenge out there. And getting across this nautical mile bay with Becky trailing in my wake.
Really, in your face, Adlington.
Yeah, I know. Well, she was a little bit scared of the sea, let's put it that way. But she was actually helping to round up some stragglers at the back. But when I did that, I never, ever thought that I'd like swimming. And I didn't. I still didn't like swimming, but I never thought that I'd be able to do that. So suddenly this idea emerged. Lots of my female friends are doing triathlon. That's another thing I never thought that I'd be able to do. And I think when one gets into one's 30s, you know, you start to question.
I remember it. Yeah, it was a long time ago, yes.
You start to question what's possible. So yeah. I think I set out 5 just to try and make it hard enough, but not crazy.
Now, I didn't realise there are different triathlons. There are kind of slightly easier ones, although they're all ridiculously difficult, would appear. There are shorter ones. Is there a kind of a standard triathlon?
Yeah, well, the Olympic distance is otherwise known as standard distance,
right,
which is what is raced by Olympians.
And so what is that? What
so
would that be?
So that is a 1,500-metre swim, a 40-kilometre ride and a 10-kilometre run.
And this is all straight after it. There's no, you don't do one day and one the next. You come out of the water. Look at you laughing at that. Because I told you I'm a very unfit man. You come out of the water wet and you get on a bike.
Yeah, you have to take your wetsuit off as well. So it's like doing 5 different events because you've got 2 transitions in between each event.
Why would you do it?
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
I think you should try it. No, and then maybe you'll find out.
No way.
I think there's lots of reasons to do it. It's a way of staying really fit whilst also balancing out the impact on your body in 3 different ways, if you like. So it's you're less at risk of injury than you would be in, say, training for the London Marathon if you're doing an Olympic distance triathlon. But I also think there's a great sense of community surrounding triathlon and the world of triathlon.
This is the thing that comes across in the book is the kind of friendships that you make up, and everybody seems very helpful. It doesn't seem particularly, well, of course it's competitive, but it's also, it is a community and people want to help and give advice and seem to welcome newcomers who want to take on the triathlon. Is that right?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I think if you are very similarly matched to another person, then that competition creeps in.
Oh, really?
But I've found that it's a bit like when you see an amazing film or hear a wonderful song or find a new band.
Yeah.
You want to tell everyone about it, and triathletes do like to shout from the rooftops.
And triathlon is the same as Ironman. Ironman is kind of the brand name.
Ironman is the brand name for a very long-distance triathlon.
Right, okay.
One particular triathlon. And actually, Ironman as a word was coined before triathlon.
Right.
And I think the first official triathlon involved fly fishing and 2 other rather strange disciplines, maybe archery, something
fishing?
Like that. Yeah, so they decided to change that. But, you know, Ironman only came about in the 70s, I think, in California. So it's all pretty new.
You talk about how your keeping fit helps with your depression and helps, you know, kind of keep you feeling positive. And I've never had that. I have had periods where I thought, I better do a bit of exercise. And I've had a personal trainer. I've done stuff. And I've never had that endorphin rush. I've never had that buzz. It's never lifted me out of the depression. What am I doing wrong?
I'm not laughing at any sadness that you feel, Ian, merely at the fact that you clearly haven't reached us. You need to sweat. Have you done that?
I mean, I really don't. That sounds unpleasant. I mean,
well, maybe it's just not for you.
I think so. It's just not for me.
Maybe you need to find something else that's kind of physically exertive.
Where's this? Where's this hideous place in Tooting Beck, Lido?
It's one of my favourite places in the world. It's 92 metres long. It's cold. It's relatively expensive. Now, the Tooting Beck Lido is a complete London treasure. It really is.
I'd never heard of it, and it's in the book. What is great is throughout the book, you keep getting people giving you advice, and you go, oh, yeah, get lost, whatever. And then you realise that generally that advice they're giving you is great. When you get into the Lido, some fella's saying, just be careful. Maybe, you know, don't stay in there too long. And you're like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll stay as long as I want. Yeah. And then it hits you that actually it sounds freezing and it sounds...
Well, that was before I got a wetsuit.
Right,
see, and it was November, so I think the water was about 5 degrees.
Right, okay.
So really you can only do a few lengths before you have to get out.
Yeah.
But I wanted to try front crawl, and every time I put my head down, it popped up like a reflex action.
What other places, where else in London did you kind of centre your training?
Well, swimming you can do in the Serpentine. Right. And a lot of triathletes do that. And the Hyde Park triathlon coming up this weekend is held there.
Okay.
The swim is done there. I did some cycling, some brick sessions where you ride, then run, over and over in Regent's Park. You can go, I mean, London is just replete with amazing opportunities.
Yeah.
Places to train, Richmond Park, Hampstead Heath. I stayed around Tooting quite a lot. I even stayed at home on a turbo, which is a contraption you attach to your bike.
What does that do?
Well, it enables you to cycle indoors. So, like, as if you're on a spin bike,
sort of,
but on your own bike.
Okay, so you're sort of, what, your back wheel's raised
your
up or something?
Your back wheel is attached to this triangular contraption, so that you get used to being on your bike, and you can train throughout the winter.
That's
what you should get.
Sounds marvellous, Lucy. Sounds absolutely marvellous. The first one you do is in St. Lucia, isn't it?
Yes, that was brilliant.
Which sounds kind of, you know, it's kind of quite nice. St. Lucia, you know.
Chill, lots of rum. Yeah, exactly.
And you're very excited that your sports bra was working, and you're going up to random people. It works! And the fella's like, what? You're going, this!
For everyone, Ian is making a gesture, touching his...
I'm holding my boobs. Chest. It does sound like it, it's a real challenge, and you come from being very fit. You do a lot of fitness. You write fitness columns. You're a personal trainer, is that?
I was for a few years.
You was.
Yeah.
But you found this flipping hard work, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I found it. Do you know, mentally, I think that was the hardest thing.
Yeah.
Because whatever you do, it feels like you're not doing enough. And I think I have a tendency to feel that way anyway.
Mm.
And so if you go swimming in the pool, you think, I should do some open water practice. You go cycling to a spin class to really get yourself fit for cycling, but you haven't been on the roads for a bit. So there's so many things to juggle, it just seems never ending. But I think that is what keeps people really interested.
I was going to ask about the mental side of it, because you talk to a woman, I think it's Susanna, who talks about her first triathlon, and she goes nuts when she's doing the running bit. She forgets how to speak English, and she can only speak in French. You know, it's a real... It's mentally torturous, isn't it? You can kind of get lost in yourself a bit.
Yeah, I'm only laughing because of your disbelief. But Suzanne went, she did experience hallucinations, and that was her second ever Ironman. She did an Ironman off the bat, though. She never did any triathlon before Ironman, and there are people who do that. I wouldn't really advise it, but she was in the heat in Nice, and the heat just got to her.
Yeah.
I mean, she was on sort of hour 12 and thought she couldn't speak English anymore.
You're not doing this Hyde Park triathlon this weekend.
I'm stepping aside this weekend.
Have you had enough of them? Have you done it? That's that done. Let's look for another challenge now.
To a certain extent, yeah. I think if I was going to take it a lot further, I'd want to look at half Ironman and Ironman.
Mm.
And my hips are not really loving that idea right now. They tend to be getting injured quite a lot. But what I have taken on is the swimming, which was the thing which I never thought I would ever do.
You weren't a fan of swimming. The cycling and the running you were kind of okay with, but you didn't enjoy swimming.
No, and I've just found it quite meditative. I've only just started again because I'm a bit of a fair-weather swimmer.
Mm.
But I'm hoping to go out to Italy this summer to swim with Swim Lab. Which is a company that takes people to beautiful places and you eat good food and swim across iconic bays.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to do that. I'd quite like to do some more proper open water swimming, actually.
Yeah.
Specifically open water, that really enticed me, because there's something about... It's almost dangerous. It feels a little bit dangerous and also quite natural, though, for us to be moving through lakes rather than pools.
Another interesting thing is the relationship with, and I've not read the end, so don't tell me if you're still together or not, but you and your partner, she becomes kind of a triathlon widow. There's hints that that's going to happen. And that's quite common in relationships, isn't it? Where one person, you say it's addictive, the world of triathlon. It seems to be the thing that once people start doing it, that's it. They get really pulled into it, don't they? At the expense sometimes of their relationships.
Yeah, I think that's a big risk with any new obsession.
Mm.
And I think it happens a lot in endurance sport these days, be it marathon, or even long distance swimming and triathlons. That's very common. So a lot of people get together with other triathletes. I've heard that triathlon clubs are often a hotbed of dating.
Gosh.
Yeah. But I just think it's good to be aware when you're doing it that maybe your partner isn't as excited by it all as you are.
Well, there's a bit in there where you say to your wife, look, if I get a bit boring about triathlons, just let me know, yeah? And she kind of goes, yeah, all right. And you know that she knows what's coming. Listen, let me play a record. We'll come back and talk a bit more. Run, Ride, Sink or Swim by Lucy Fry.
Elfie.
A little bit of Cilla Black. Just a little bit. I mean, Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Right, joined by Lucy Fry, who's written Run, Ride, Sink or Swim. Now, the subheading, A Year in the Exhilarating and Addictive World of Women's Triathlon. But we were just saying, it's not a book about triathlons, really, is it? It's, the popular phrase is, it's a journey. And it is, it's an emotional journey, isn't it? It's kind of a roller coaster ride of your life.
Yeah, that an emotional roller coaster. That is my life. How well put, Ian. Yeah, it is very much about the emotional roller coaster of endurance sports. And by that, I mean anything where you do things for more than an hour.
Mm.
And the different places that you go to and how one gets to know oneself.
Do you know yourself, Lucy? Do you?
I'm constantly evolving.
You're trying to learn more. The thing I find is the dedication. You're very determined, aren't you? You'd set yourself a challenge, and even though, because you had injuries, you'd mentioned your hips and your leg was a bit funny, there was stuff going on, you weren't going to let that deter you. Because I would have just gone, I'll forget it, I'm going to watch Judge Judy instead, you know, and that I would have given up at the first hurdle. You carried on. How do you do that?
Well, I had a supportive partner, and yep. I had some physio, a great physio, a guy called Barry, who really, really helped me. And a lot of sports massage. I basically poured all of my money into keeping my body intact and tried to just maintain some semblance of perspective about it all.
Mm.
And I hardly did any running during the course of the year, except in the races.
Right, okay.
Really minimal. Yeah. So it was pretty difficult, actually.
This Hyde Park triathlon, what would be your kind of key piece of advice for anybody who's doing their first triathlon?
Well, which distance? I mean, that would be the question, because there's a sprint distance and an Olympic distance.
Right.
Triathlon is for everyone, for all, you know, walks of life, and people can enter a distance that suits them. So if you're going for the sprint, like I did,
yeah.
which still takes about an hour and a half or 2 hours even, I would say just go for it, enjoy it, because it's a really flat course. So you can really go all out. And for the Olympic, obviously pace yourself a bit more, but mostly just, I think Hyde Park is such an iconic course, you know, the Olympians raced there. So just enjoy being there and with the crowds, and there's loads of tourists around, everybody's cheering you on. I honestly just enjoy it. Somebody once said to me, make sure you remember to smell the roses. And I thought that was quite a lovely idea, just that you can get so caught up in looking at your watch, you forget to just be, you know, aware of the fact that I'm here.
The solution one is the one that sticks in mind, because it's your first one and you've got an upset stomach. Let's not go into too much detail, but it doesn't sound nice. And you carry on, and you're so pleased with yourself that I've done the swimming bit. I've done that. I'm on the second bit, you know, and you're kind of, you're taking your time and you keep your goggles on, and you know, it does sound like it's, well, it just sounds, you achieve a lot and you're pleased with the achievement, as opposed to checking the watch, is this my personal best?
I mean, in St. Lucia, I really was, because my leg was pretty sore and I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to do it. And then I had the upset stomach. So by the time I actually started, just finishing was good enough. And there's such a great atmosphere out there, and the sun was shining. It was 30 degrees at 9 a.m., you know. But by the time I got to Newcastle, which was the final one I did 9 months later, I really did care about my transition times. And I really did care how fast I ran the 9.6K run or whatever it was at the end. So I think triathlon gets a hold of one's competitive side. It certainly did for me, or not so much how I appeared against other women who were racing, but how I did in comparison to my younger self, if you like.
And lots of women doing it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a growing sport.
28%, I think. I just read some new figures from the Triathlon Industry Association. We make up 28%, which is obviously not enough, but There's
a really interesting thing as well, quite early on in the book, what is it, about men and women's attitude being different towards endurance sports, and men kind of go for it, gung-ho, I can do this, there's not a problem, and women are a bit more thoughtful about it, and quite often the men will pull out halfway through an event because they've gone too fast. And it's a tortoise and the hare thing, isn't it? And the women kind of tend to carry on because they're more methodical.
Yeah, and I think that can be really positive. Women take the training quite seriously, but I think, and obviously these are all sweeping generalisations, but I do think that women tend to underplay themselves too, and maybe just, they don't really go for it enough.
It's a good read. I wish you the best of luck with it. What's the next challenge? Have you got one lined up?
Well, some swimming this summer. I've just started a bit of parkour, free running.
Oh!
So, yeah, I'm interested in that. And that's with Parkour Generations in
I've got to go. Look, don't get such good guests. I could talk to them all day. Is parkour still a big thing? Because that was big about 10 years ago, wasn't it? And then it kind of faded a little bit
It was big in the media about 10 years ago. But now we're talking regular people. Wow. Anyone can do it. Anyone can be taught now.
See, I might be up for a bit of that.
Yeah? Well, yeah. I'll give you the details after
Thank
the show.
You very much indeed. Look, the book Thank is you. Called Run, Ride, Sink or Swim. It's by Lucy Fry. It's a cracking read. Well done. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
0207 224 2000.
This is BBC London 94.9. Listen to Vanessa Phelps.
You know, I'm talking to the radio all the time as we're going through this.
Weekday mornings from 9.
I have a story that may be a little bit uplifting for everyone.
Good. Or via the BBC iPlayer.
Good. Thank you, Lucy. I enjoyed that a lot. You get these gigs. You get told, you're going to read a book about a year in the exhilarating and addictive world of women's triathlon. You go, oh, blimey. It's a cracking read. If anyone's doing the triathlon this weekend in Hyde Park, the thing I've still not got from reading half of the book, and I'll finish the rest this week, and from speaking to Lucy, I still don't get why. I've tried that thing. People say, oh, you do exercise, the endorphins, it'll help depression, it'll make you feel good about yourself. I've never ever had that. And I go back to it. Every couple of years, I go back to it and I'll get a personal trainer or I'll join a gym or I'll do something. I'll go running. And I've never had the endorphin hit. I've never. What am I doing wrong? I've broken into sweats. 0207 224 2000. If you could let me know why. It's also notes and queries today, as it's a Wednesday. And we're talking about the Apple tailoring. Not the boutique owned by the Beatles, the Taylors. They owned a Taylors. I'd never heard of this, and I thought I knew everything Beatles-related. Never heard of it. If you've been there, if you've got a piece of clothing from it, 0207 224 2000, my own personal indulgence, I'm asking about the Beatles' Let It Be rooftop gig. Did you see it? Did you hear it? Did you know what was going on? But the one that's really got your imagination... By the way, we've got time if you want to throw a few more questions into the mix. You're more than welcome. We'll get some texts in a bit as well. 81333, start your text, London. The one that's caught your imagination... was it Vic that came up with that? Yeah. The Parrot Man. The Parrot Man in Chelsea. Well, on the Facebook page, Robert's Facebook page, you're going nuts for it. Dodge says, they ain't parrots, I don't think. The one he was wearing when I saw him was big. Graham's posted a picture of him. My wife took this photo of him in Berkeley Square last Friday. He's known as the Parrot Man of Fulham. Tony said 40 minutes ago, just seen him in Mayfair. Paul seen him in Brompton Cemetery. And then Carpet Martin on Twitter says, the guy with the birds in Chelsea, I've seen him a number of times. For your information, FYI, they are hyacinth macaws at £15,000 a throw. No. No bird is 15 grand for a bird. Really? I don't know anything about birds. And I want to know who this guy is. He's out there now. He's out in London now. Now, listen, I don't want to hassle him. I don't want to, I don't want anything. And if, he doesn't seem approachable, then don't approach. But, if you do, and he seems like he's a nice fella and he's talkative, dial our number and hand him your telephone, please. 0207 224 2000. I would love to speak to him and find out, what on earth is going on? We're going to speak to Jerry Cottle Jr. in a few minutes, founder of the Rooftop Cinema Club, and, there's also an underground cinema club. So we're trying to find the parrot man of Chelsea or Fulham or wherever it is he may be. If you've got any other questions, by the way, for notes and queries, 0207 224 2000. You can text as well, 81333. Start your text London. And loads of you have been emailing pictures of this Beatles Apple tailoring shop. David and Graham in particular, thank you for those. We'll talk about that more after two. 0207 224 2000. Right. Jerry Cottle Jr., nice to see you. Come close to the microphone. Don't be shy. Don't be shy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Very, very nice to meet you.
You too.
You're far too perky for 20 to 2 in the afternoon. This is. I'm winding down a bit now. You're here for a couple of things. The Rooftop Film Club.
Yes.
I'd never heard of this.
Okay.
But as soon as I heard the title, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Is it what it says it is?
It is. It's you know, classic cult films. On a rooftop, and great urban environments around the city, and just watching your favourite film in a really...
Come a bit closer. Now,
yeah,
why...
Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly.
Okay.
As we've heard, listen, these BBC studios, they're not as good as you would expect from the BBC.
Looks
okay.
Pretty nice.
Why rooftops?
Why rooftops? To be honest, it's all about... It's quite simple. We say you get up there, it's a great view,
yeah,
and then it's your favourite film equals a great, great experience. But I just think, because especially in this amazing city we're in London,
yeah,
to be able to... Parks are beautiful, but to be out surrounded by buildings, so sometimes you'll be watching a film, and then you'll be, there's a cleaner over there, or someone's still in the office. So it really is like these urban environments, to be able to be right in the middle of them, and of course then we use headphones as well, and that sort of sets off, so we don't disturb any of the neighbours, and you really watch, you know... really is a different kind of experience.
One of the things I discovered about London from a very young age, look up. Always look up. When you're at whatever street you're in, look up. Because no one looks up. And the tops of buildings, there's so much more to see. You look down, you're going to see Gap and Next and Boots, doing a big deal. You look up and you're seeing history there. You know, you're seeing stuff. And also, if you're working in a tall building, there's a hotel just around the corner from where we are here at the Broadcasting House. And I can't remember what it's called, but it looks like a nothing special hotel. But if you go in and go to the top floor, they've got
get to the roof.
Get to the roof. You've got the canteen there. You can see all across London, and
rooftops
are fascinating.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're becoming more popular. Obviously, New York's known for the rooftops, but I think they're becoming more popular here. I think a little, you know, better weather like today, so there's more rooftop bars opening. Obviously, the fact that, you know, our rooftop cinemas are really popular now, and I've been over the last sort of 4 or 5
years. But there are gardens up there. There are trees up there. You can see naughty things up there.
It's a great space for spying on people. Yeah.
I love it. What films are you showing there at the rooftop cinema?
So the rooftop, we are very well known for our cult classics, so we show a lot of cult films, new release as well, so either something that you love and you cherish, you know, like a Back to the Future or a Top Gun, and you know you want to go and see it with your friends, or it's new releases, so something that's just come out in the cinema and you're like, you've either seen it once, you think I'm going to go and see that again on the rooftop, or you just missed it off the cinema and it's just off cinema, you go, you know what, I'm going to take my friends and go and see that at the Rooftop Film Club. So it's a real mix of either really old stuff or really new stuff, but all the classics.
You mentioned Top, isn't it funny how Top Gun is kind of looked at as a classic, because when coming out, and it was a bit of a joke, wasn't it? It was a bit of a Tom Cruise joke. But now everyone talks like about Top Gun in the same way they they talk about some kind of lost classic or something. It's funny, isn't it?
Oh, it's just got the thing is it's one of those, you know, it's gender neutral. Everyone can enjoy it. It's got a cracking 80s soundtrack. It's Tom Cruise, you know, in his heyday, and it's one of those. It's easy watching. You know, people. I think the other thing about pop up cinema ourselves, especially, it's a fun night out. And it's an affordable night out as well. It's, you know, people going out, and it's not costing you a fortune to go out. You go there, it's the same price as a normal cinema ticket, and you can just go and watch your favourite film and eat great food and have great drinks, but you know, all.
And it sounds, we were talking about the event. I mean, when I was a kid in the 70s and 80s, my mum would, you know, it was a special treat, she'd take us to the cinema and we went to The Empire Strikes Back and Octopussy and Popeye bizarrely, but it was kind of a thing. And cinema now, I take my boys to the cinema, they're 5 and 3, and we went and saw the Moomins the other day, but it is really expensive just to, if you just want to go to the cinema, so to make it more of an event like this rooftop club, you just feel like you're getting more bang for your buck, don't you?
Yeah, you do, and I think also another thing, you know, you sort of touched on there, is for us, the thing I think really works with the Rooftop Film Club and the underground cinema, which we'll talk about in a minute, is that it's kind of brought the community back to cinema, pop-up cinema has, you go there and it's a shared experience with your friends, and it's a good night out. Like you said, it's an affordable night out. But, you know, my parents used to tell me, and I remember as a kid going to the cinema,
yeah.
and, you know, you go to the fish and chip shop afterwards.
Yeah,
like
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now you kind of walk in and, you use a machine to get your ticket.
Yeah.
You're normally met by someone with a, you know, who doesn't really want to serve you a hot dog. You have a hot dog, mate. You know, and it's great. And it's all really about the film. Pop-up cinema's not like that. It's all about the experience. It's about the location. It's about you're seeing your favourite film.
Yeah.
It's about the food
and
drinks.
It's the whole thing.
It's the whole thing.
We've got an excellent independent cinema near us where it is kind of like cinema was in the 70s and 80s, and people will talk to you, and the guy comes out and asks my kids what they thought of the film. And,
amazing.
And by the way, taking kids to the cinema, hearing a cinema full of people laughing, it's just a joy. So the Rooftop Cinema Club.
Rooftop Film Club, yeah.
Rooftop Film Club, apologies.
Yes, all right. No,
how long's that been going for?
So that's been going 5 years,
and it's working, and
it's
people
been
are digging
fantastic.
It.
We've now got three permanent venues: Stratford, Peckham, and Shoreditch. They've been open since May. They run all the way till September, and we're just about to also open in New York next week.
Hey.
So yes,
and are you going to be at the opening of that?
I'm going to go there.
Of course you are.
Yeah,
of course you are.
It's a dream. It's a dream. The American dream.
Okay, so you've done Rooftops.
Rooftops. Yeah.
Now you're going completely the other end.
We're going. We're going to cut out the bit in the middle.
Yeah.
And we're going to do you cut that bit, the normal bit, and we're going for. So what we're doing? We're very lucky actually. Over the next sort of 5 days, we're going to be basically staging a number of special pop-up cinema events in Charing Cross Station, and this is
fantastic.
All part of a really really special, really a part of a series of events that London Underground are doing to celebrate the launch of the Night Tube, and it's amazing for us because this is a genuine station. You know, this is a disused part of the station, and you know, you don't get access to this normally. The only times you get access to this are like it's as a film location, so public don't get access to it. No public have been there since 1999, when it was then it was basically extended onto the Jubilee Line, was extended to Docklands, and then it finished being used. So this is the first time public have access, you know, for the last.
You were saying the Charing Cross Station is where Bond was,
and that's right. So but that's it. So but what it's known for, or not really known for, but what it has been used for is Skyfall, that great scene with Daniel Craig, he's falling down the escalator shooting. Javier Bardem comes in. It's been used at Paddington recently. You know, Thor. It's all these great movies. So as a film location, stunning, and to actually get access to this, you know, this for what we do, you know, we're over the moon.
So how does it work? Where are you going to show the film? Where's it going to be projected? And where am I going
to
sit?
Yeah. So just to give you, it's actually in the heart of Charing Cross Station. This one's amazing, but this is what we've been sort of working on and planning for the last few months. So you're going to Charing Cross Station, and then you're just to set the tone. You're then going to another area, this disused part of the station. And you'll enter and you'll go down the escalators, the ones you see in Skyfall, they'll all be lit up. Then you'll actually enter the real concourse. That'll be like the cinema foyer, if you like. So there, you know, there'll be drinks and food. And then you actually have the platforms either side, so the railways either side, but we'll lead you round into another platform, and that's where we'll have a nice big screen set up. There'll be comfortable seating. It's all on headphones, you don't get any disturbance from around you. And it really, like I said, it really is a proper, just a genuine digital station, and you're watching, you know, a really amazing pop-up.
Get your pens and papers. Kids, because we'll give you the details in a few minutes. Yeah. Go off and get your pens and papers. We want to make sure. Are you allowed to say what the film is, or is that a surprise? You find out when you get there.
No, we've got films running from Friday. So we've got a mixture of things like Strangers on the Train. We've also got Paddington for the kids on
Saturday. Which, by the way, guys, I mean, I've seen it a million times. My boys are 5 and 3. We've seen it a million times. It is brilliant, isn't it? It is brilliant,
so that
film.
That's featured in the films. That's fantastic. There is we sold out the tickets very quickly, but there's a new batch going on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock.
Okay.
So if you want a chance to still get some tickets, we've saved some space, so, you know, there's a chance.
And
there.
this is to celebrate the launch of the Underground opening through the night.
Yeah, so we work very close with London Underground. You know, honestly, they've been brilliant to allow the access. Like I said, this really is special. So we've worked with them, and the idea is they're doing these events. Mm. They've already done a photography exhibition in Westminster, but they're doing a series of events, and it's to celebrate the fact that in September there'll be the night, the tube is going through the night, and it's to benefit. The idea is it's highlighting the benefits to people like us, the entertainment industry, and people being able to get access late at night to be able to go to events like these. So yeah, it's really this.
So this is only happening for a limited run. Is there any chance that it might happen again? It might get extended.
Well, if London, hopefully they'll be happy with everything you're doing. We'd love to do it more in the future. We do have an underground film club at Christmas at Waterloo, but we're hoping this is, you know, hopefully we'll be able to do it again in the future. We'd love to.
Jerry, stay there. I'm going to play a record. Yep. Go and get pen and paper, boys and girls, and we'll give you the details of how you can find out after a little bit of Tony Bennett. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tony Bennett. Huh? Mr. Tony Bennett. Huh? Jerry Cottle Jr. is here. Very famous name, of course. Is the name ever a burden to you at all?
No, you know what? Not at all. And it's a good question, but not at all. Like, I'm, Dad's just celebrated his 70th birthday, and he's created amazing opportunities for me in life. I've seen lots of parts of the world growing up as a kid, but I also had the best of both worlds with, you know, good education and the circus. Not at all. I'm really proud of my father.
But did you never want to do... The classic thing is to run away with the circus. Did you never want to run away to normality?
I actually ran away from the circus. Yeah. So all my sisters and even my niece and nephew now, they're all involved with the circus. They still, you know, do you know, amazing sort of acrobatics and juggling acts and everything else. But I'm the only one of the family who kind of... I ran away to, you know, I ran away to London. And I love it here.
The acrobatics in a circus environment, they scare... I get too anxious. I'm so worried that something's going to happen to them. I'm just sitting there going, please, just... And there's a round of applause. Oh, they made it. They're still alive. Yeah, you know, it's a terrifying thing.
We started it in this country, circus. So it's an amazing...
Oh, it's great.
It's never had been funded. And, you know, I think in a couple of years... 2018, it celebrates 250 years...
Is it really?
...of circus here in the UK. And we, the rest of the world, see the Britain as the, you know, sort of the start of circus.
Funny, isn't it? Because there is a connection with what you're doing. You're setting up magic. The circus coming to town, you know, the tent gets erected and magic is made, you know, and it's the same thing with the rooftop and the underground.
It's bummed on seats.
Exactly.
I love seeing people smile. I used to watch my dad when he was younger. He used to watch the circus, but I noticed he wasn't even watching the acts. He was watching the people. He was looking around and he was, you know, really gave an amazing buzz. And I feel that maybe, you know, I picked that up from dad. And same with the cinemas. I love to see people enjoy themselves. So I feel very blessed.
I think there is a connection. How did you get all the equipment? Because cinema equipment is big and it's cumbersome and it's heavy.
We've got a big screen going in. Well, actually, it's amazing, really. And this is where, you know, obviously London Underground being fantastic to work with, and they've really gone out of the way. A lot of organisation. We've loaded a train at Stanmore off rush hours, so we're not disrupting everyone. It really is like, you know, it's really been clinical to make sure it's all smooth. Yeah. So we've loaded everything into a train, and that's going to be pulling into Charing Cross Station. That part of it, like I said, it doesn't disturb the rest of it. Pulling into the station, everything will be unloaded.
This train is delayed because some clowns are unloading a screen somewhere.
But no, so it's been, you know, it's been a real sort of amazing technical sort of setup. But we're loading it all in, and it'll all be set up. And it, like I said, it starts on Friday, and we kick off with Strangers on a Train, and then American Werewolf in London, which an amazing underground scene.
That wasn't filmed at Charing Cross, was it? Where was that filmed? Was that Tottenham Court Road? I think so.
I don't know, to be perfect.
No, I've got a feeling. I know it's set in Tottenham Court Road, and I think it might be. Yeah. That's a great film.
That's a great film and an amazing scene. There'll be a few hairs on the back of the neck going up.
Well, also, there's two great scenes. There's that, and there's Jenny Agutter in the shower. As a child of the 80s, it was a powerful moment. Right. Some more tickets are being released this weekend,
on Saturday at 10 o'clock, and we'll also be released. Keep an eye on our social media handles, Rooftop Film Club. We're going to put some tickets out there. We want as many people.
Is there a website or something?
Yes, undergroundfilmclub.com.
Okay.
We're getting as many people as we possibly can in the short space of time.
So, undergroundfilmclub.com. I'm assuming there's a rooftopfilmclub.com as well.
Rooftopfilmclub.com, for the rooftop venues that we have running till September. Yeah.
And you mentioned that Paddington. I'm assuming that kids can go.
Yes, so that's so perfect. So we obviously want everyone to enjoy it. So there's a kid screening at 2 o'clock of Paddington on Saturday. Right. Saturday coming up. Yeah.
Okay. What's your favourite film of all time?
Favourite film of all time? Oh, God.
I should have asked you at the start as to whether this interview continues or not. This tells a lot about a person.
Favourite film, Shawshank Redemption? I love that. I love that story of hope. It's one of those I watch straight away.
It is a good film. I've just signed up to one of these.
I love Top Gun and stuff like that because they're just ridiculous.
I've never seen Top Gun.
Redemption's my favourite, yeah. You've never seen Top Gun?
I've just signed up to one of those internet streaming sites that we have to say at the BBC. And there's two main ones. And really... they really encourage you to lower your standards, don't they? Because each one has got about three good films on there, and then I found myself last night watching The Fugitive with Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones. It's a good film.
Yeah.
But it was I wouldn't have chosen to watch it had there been something decent to watch.
Favorite film?
My favorite film. Okay, it's
a big question. I know.
It's a great question. It's I've got two.
Okay,
The Monkey's Head.
Right.
Because I love that. But also Al Pacino in Dog Day Afternoon.
Okay.
A great understated performance by Al Pacino.
I'll have to play that at the rooftop.
Do you take requests? Do you ever?
Yeah, of course. You know, it's all about the, you know, the rooftop fans, if you like. That's what we're like a big community cinema. Yeah. So we get people encourage us to, you know, sort of, you know, go on social media and suggest films, and we put it out there.
And you love it. I can tell you love it. This is not fake. You came in with a big grin on your face. This isn't that fake enthusiasm of a snake oil salesman. You really enjoy what you do.
I love what I do. I feel very blessed to be doing something that's going very well. So that's, you know, yeah.
Jerry, so nice to meet you.
You You too.
I really wish you the best of luck with this. I love stuff like this because it's nuts. Yeah. And I'm glad that there are nuts people like you that are doing it.
Jerry, the flag for nuts people.
Jerry Cockle Jr., thank you so much indeed for coming in. 0207-224-2000 is the telephone number if you want to give us a call. You're more than welcome. We're trying to track down... By the way, if you've been to any of these rooftop films, they give us a call and let us know what it was like. What happens if it rains on the rooftop?
If it rains, we like all outdoor events, we do screen rain or shine. But we make sure you're looked after, blankets. Because very often showers are just for a short period of time. Shower, blankets, and we give everything, and so we look after you. But we don't cancel. Because
I love it.
Spring rain or shine.
I love it.
People want it. People like to see it. Yeah. They want it to go ahead, honestly.
Thank you very much, Jerry Cockle Jr.
Thank you very much.
If you've seen the Parrot Man of Fulham, 0207-224-2000, you can text as well, 81333. This is Ian Lee on BBC London 94.9. I'm sitting in for Robert Elms. We've got another hour to go. We've got Tia Gilmore coming in the next hour, which is very exciting.
BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
Thank you, Will. Thank you, Sarah. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. He was sitting in for Robert Elms, he's having the Delph. He's back tomorrow, as far as I'm aware. Don't panic. The thing I love about this gig is everybody's so enthusiastic and so nice. I mean, you guys as well, but I'm talking primarily about the guests. Wasn't Jerry Cockle Jr. delightful? And he was so enthusiastic. He was so enthusiastic, he came in bounding in with a big grin. Thank you for having me on. I love the idea of that. Films on the cinema and films on the underground. Yes, please. Last hour of the show, Joe Good's on at 3. We've got Tia Gilmore coming in about half an hour or so to play a song live and have a chat about her new album. We've also your questions and answers for notes and queries. I love this because you guys know everything. You know everything. What have we had? Well, I threw out about the Beatles rooftop concert. I'm a big Beatles fan, and I'm in a real Beatles vibe at the moment. I saw a Beatles tribute band on Sunday, and then I went and saw Paul McCartney, two-thirds of which was brilliant, one-third was new. It was classic after rubbish, new one after classic. It was pretty much how it went. How old is McCartney? He's got to be 72, 73. It was brilliant. It was a brilliant concert. There's no denying that. Did you see the Beatles rooftop concert in 1969? Did you hear it? Did you know what it was? Did it disturb your work? Did it get in the way? 0207-224-2000. We also had a call from Vic, who wanted to know about the gentleman who has two parrots on his shoulders in Fulham and Chelsea, kind of around that area. We're told they're not parrots, they're macaws that could be about 15 grand each. What do you know about? Do you know him? Have you spoken to him? Is he friendly? Is he approachable? Why has he got two giant birds on his shoulders? What's he thinking? 81333, start your text, London. And the Apple, we all knew about the Apple Boutique. I think most of us would have known about the Apple Boutique. It was their folly. It was their foray into the world of, psychedelic fashions. Didn't work. I think the boutique only lasted about 6 months, and in the end, they gave everything away. But we had a call from Wayne, who was asking about Apple tailoring on the King's Road. I had never heard about this, and I'm... When it comes to the Beatles, I'm pretty anal. In fact, I read a book about Apple about 6 months ago, and Apple tailoring wasn't mentioned in it. Well, we know it exists. We've been sent pictures. Thank you for those. Did you ever go in there? Have you still got a suit tailed? Tailed, is that the word? Tailored? Tailored? I'm going to say tail. Butler's buttle, so tailor's tail, I've decided. Did you have a suit tailed in Apple tailoring at the King's Road? 81333, start your text, London, or 0207-224-2000. Oh, come on. Come on, guys. Honestly, that's one of those songs, right, that we've all heard millions of times. And so when we listen to it, our brains switch off. There are a few songs like that. What I try and do with those songs is I try to listen to it with fresh ears as though I've never heard it before. And it's just joyous, isn't it? It's just joyous. Another good one for that is Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. You've heard that a million times, and it's... Good Vibrations. No. Sit down and make yourself listen to it as though it's the first time you've ever heard it. It's amazing. 0207 224 2000. Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Notes and queries. If you've got something that you've been scratching your head about, that you've seen, you've heard, you've smelt, you've touched in London, well, this is the place to come. The Beatles rooftop concert, Apple tailoring, and the Parrot Man in Chelsea. Where should we go to? Let's start with Tony, shall we? Good afternoon, Tony and Barnett.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you, mate. How are you doing?
Good, yeah, great, thank you. As soon as I heard this, wow, my ears pricked up. I had to phone you.
Go on, you're calling in about the rooftop concert,
the
are
rooftop
you?
Rooftop, yeah, I was there. I worked in Savile Row, 1819 Savile Row, almost opposite West End Central.
Yeah.
And I managed a store, a menswear store called John Michael, which is now dead and buried, unfortunately, the store. And I heard the music coming out, and I thought, that is it. We closed the store, and everybody rushed to the end of Savile Row. Oh, it was absolutely amazing.
How old were you, Tony?
21.
21, okay. So you were a hip young guy. You must have known that the Beatles' offices were based there. Did you see them kind of wandering around?
No, I didn't, actually.
Right.
In fact, I worked next door. Cliff Richard and the Shadows had their offices next door to us.
Not quite as cool as the Beatles.
No, indeed. Indeed. But once I heard that, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing for us.
Did you know it was the Beatles? Did you? You knew what was going on?
Yeah, yeah. You could hear the noise. You got sucked in with the people. We walked up there. You could hear it was a horrible cold day.
Yeah.
I always remember, you know, January 69, it wasn't pleasant. And this music was playing and, it was so emotional. You know, you were listening and crying and taking it all in. It was just, you know, to be that near to your idols or people that I loved.
And were you, you were a Beatles fan, were you?
Very much so.
Because they'd been kind of quiet they hadn't played a gig, I think, for 3 or 4 years.
That's right.
And were you watching from the ground, or were you able to go up on the roof and watch?
No, you couldn't get up there. Right. There were more security. No, I was watching from the ground.
Wow.
Looking up and just taking it all in. You know, I got a feeling, one after 9:09, and it was just, how you just live with these things. In fact, my kids would go, oh, Dad, not the Beatles. But they were brought up on the Beatles.
Yeah.
And to me, that's our era. It was the greatest memory. It was a wonderful, wonderful era that you know, we still remember.
I, myself, Tony, am deeply, deeply envious that you saw that. I mean, I've seen the... Have you seen the film?
What, of the Let It Be film?
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so you've seen the concert.
It was a documentary, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm deeply envious. And and were there people tutting going, oh, wish they'd get their hair cuts and shut up? Or was everybody digging the Beatles?
No. It was cool to be part of the crowd.
Oh, man. Tony, I'm deep. What do you do now, Tony?
Now, I've got an export company. I work with the Red Cross and charities in Sierra Leone.
Hey, well, good for you. There's a change from menswear.
Oh, completely. Completely.
Tony,
another world.
Tony, it's so nice to talk to you. Thank you for that, mate.
Likewise. Thank you for your time.
Ta-ta. I am taking... I've got... he won't be listening to this because he doesn't know. I've got two boys, 5 and 3. I am a huge Monkees fan, and the Monkees are playing in London in September, right? I've got special permission from my wife to take my oldest boy, the 5-year-old, to the Monkees concert. They love the Monkees. I don't know how to break it to the youngest, because the youngest is going to be gutted. But we've got front row seats to go. I know it's the Monkees versus the Beatles. All right, guys, calm down. But we've got front row seats, and my 5-year-old, when I tell him, will go nuts, because they're constantly singing, I'm Not Your Stepping Stone, Hey, Hey, the Monkees, and as they call it, Last Train to Fartsville. I'm hoping he kind of grows out of that by the time we get there, but... and it's that thing, you know, you kind of... Quite often the best gig you've ever been to is your first gig. But what a gig to see the Beatles live on the rooftop. Thank you for that. What a brilliant memory. David's in central London. Good morning, I keep saying good morning, sorry. Good afternoon, David. Oh, David, where are you? You're there. Sorry, David, you're on that one. How are you today? You're right.
I'm very well, Ian. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Apart from getting the AM and the PM confused, as I often do in my old age. The Parrot Man. Have you seen the Parrot fella?
No, I've not seen the fella, but I will tell you that there is a lady who... I've seen her twice now, in the South Kensington, sort of Earl's Court area.
Yeah.
And she walks her dogs with a parrot on each shoulder.
What?
Honestly, I tell you, the first time I saw her, I nearly crashed the van because I just couldn't believe. She was just walking along as bold as daylight with a parrot on each shoulder walking her dog.
I don't understand. What is this obsession with parrots and birds? Maybe they're a couple. Maybe this is what they get up to. Maybe this is their thing.
It's not a million miles away from where this other guy is from, really. So I mean, they could be related.
Did you speak to her? Because I would be tempted to go up and go, I've got to ask, what's going on with the birds?
Yeah, do you know what? I would have done, but I was driving, obviously, in traffic, and there just wasn't the opportunity to pull up. But it was, I mean, she just was oblivious to everybody else, and it didn't seem to me that anyone was really taking much notice of her, and I thought, am I seeing things here? But it was true, you know.
A friend of mine saw someone taking, you talk about taking pets for a walk, saw someone taking a cat for a walk the other day on a lead. Now that's nuts, isn't it?
It is a bit, isn't it?
You can't put a lead on cats.
No.
Oh, maybe you can. All right, listen, David, thank you very much for that. Oh, this instead of clearing the waters, you've muddied the waters even more. Okay, so we know that there is a fella that walks around with parrots, or macaws, for you pedants, on his shoulders. Well, now there's a woman not that far away who also does a similar thing. Are they related? Are they husband and wife? Is this some kind of weird bird relationship? I never got birds as pets. 0207-224-2000, by the way. I never understood birds as pets. Okay, I've got a cat. I've had my cat for 14 years. She's 16 years old. She's wonderful. She's not going to be around for much longer, I don't think. She's very thin. I've also got a rabbit. A rabbit is a rubbish pet. I mean, it doesn't do anything apart from scratch me when I try and pick him up. Benji, but he's rubbish. Doesn't do anything. We've also got stick insects. What? You know, what's that all about? But birds as pets, Alan, do you get birds as pets?
No.
I don't understand what pleasure they can bring. It's a strange thing to go, do you know what this house needs? We need a bird flying around. That's what we need. Alan, what have you called in for? What have you got for us?
Well, I've called in about Apple tailoring, actually.
Okay.
Because I used to run the store Dandy Fashions, which became Apple Tailoring.
Oh, Dandy Fashions. There's a great name for a shop.
Yeah.
So you ran Dandy Fashions, and then that closed down, and what, Apple Tailoring took over that premises, did they?
Well, the Beatles were customers of Dandy's, and it was backed by Tyra Brown of the Guinness Trust, of the Guinness family. And when he tragically got killed in a car crash, which was mentioned in the song Day in the Life.
Yeah, of course, yes.
The Beatles eventually bought out the Guinness Trust interest because they didn't want to be backing a shop like Dandy's, and it made sense for the Beatles, who had, I guess, a lot of money swashing around, to get in there and take over that position.
So, did you say the Beatles came into your shop?
Yeah.
Did you serve them?
Yeah.
Oh, you say so nonchalantly. If I ever met anybody, that would be the first thing I'd say. Hey, you know I serve the Beatles. which ones? All of them?
Yeah. I mean, there's pictures of all of them wearing Dandy's clothes.
Wow.
At different times, the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, Procol Harum. I mean, you know, it was a place to go, you know.
Okay, and so Apple Tailoring replaced it. And do we know how long it stayed there? Do we know if it was successful?
I couldn't say, really. It didn't stay there that long,
no.
I don't think. You know, that era moved on of dandyism and things and went somewhere slightly more sort of conventional.
Yeah.
But they used the same manufacturing line at Apple Tailoring that we used at Dandy Fashions, which was Foster Tara, which was a really sort of innovative tailoring establishment.
Alan, I really appreciate. I love this gig. You get such great calls. You get people, you know, that sold clothes to the Beatles. How cool is that, Alan? Thank you very much indeed. Graham's in Maidenhead. Good afternoon, Graham.
Good afternoon, Ian. Good afternoon.
You know about this, the Apple Tailor. Had you heard of Dandy's?
Yeah, the gentleman on before me has practically said everything. Yeah, John Crittle was running the fashion shop. Actually, the reason why the Beatles took over, Dan, is because one of their managing directors was Neil Aspinall.
Yeah, oh yeah, of course, yeah, yeah.
Was head of the Beatles, Apple, eventually. Yeah. And the salon downstairs, which was run by a chap named Leslie Cavendish, she got the job because he was cutting their hair at the time. If you look at the Beatles in 65, 66, their hairstyle changed at 67, and he had a hand in that.
Wow.
And Apple Tailoring shut down in 68 because they realised they were losing money, and they just literally gave it to John Crittle to run on his own back. So,
did you ever go in the shop, Graham?
No, because I used to hang around in Abbey Road, around that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Beatles actually were interested in fashion because they used to go down to Granny Takes a Trip, which is just literally the other side of the road, further up on the King's Road, and they thought, why should we start buying clothes when we can have them designed by ourselves?
How's things in Maidenhead, Graham? I used to go to the... When I was a little boy, I used to go to the Magnet Leisure Centre in Maidenhead every Sunday and learn Kung Fu.
Is it still there, mate?
Is it still there?
Yeah. The reason why I also don't know if you know, the Apple Tailoring used to be is now Paper Chase Shop.
Right.
It's on the corner of Flood Street. And Flood Walk, which is just round the corner of it, is where the Beatles had their photographs taken for the Sgt. Pepper cover.
Aha. You see, it all links up. Graham, I really appreciate your call. Thank you very much indeed. We never managed to find... Listen, you've still got time. If you bought a suit from Apple Tailoring, 0207 224 2000... Thank you for that, Graham. Art Garfunkel, when will those guys ever stop fighting? Was in the papers this week slagging off Paul Simon again, saying that he suffered from short man syndrome. Paul Simon, of course, is tiny. To save money in the 60s, he would hide in the turn-up of Art Garfunkel's trousers.
That's not really true.
Yeah, he was in that, because I thought they'd kind of, you know, they'd had their fallings out in the 70s and the 80s, and they'd made peace. But there was an interview with him where he was having a right old pop at Paul Simon. Deary me. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. Here till 3 o'clock. Joe's on at 3. Don't worry, normal service will resume. We'll speak to her in a bit to find out exactly what's going on in her show. Afternoon, this... Oh, I've left travel open. That's what that hubbub was. I was getting all cocky going, well, this 2.5 hours of sitting in for Robert on this new desk and this new computer system, I've got it sorted. And then, look, That's what happens in the travel room. Be careful, because they're very potty-mouthed in there. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee. Don't worry, Robert Elms will be back tomorrow. Normal service will resume. And Joe Good's going to be on at 3. The lovely, delightful bonkers, let's be honest, but wonderful Joe Good. She's going to pop in a bit and tell us what's going on. Our next guest is coming in a bit. And, well, I'm excited because it's live music, and I've heard there's a bit of fiddle involved as well, and, you know, violin involved as well, which is always great. Tia or Thea? I'm realising I don't actually know how to pronounce the name. Tia Gilmore? I would say... Well, I tell you what I'll do. We'll play a record and we'll ask her, shall we? It's only polite. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. He's back tomorrow, don't panic. I'm excited that we decide. What have we decided we're going to call you lot? A band? A group? What are you today?
Well, we were toying with bards. That sounded wrong.
Now you said it amplified, it sounds rude,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But I'm still there. I'm still on it.
You can go back a little bit from that microphone. There we go. Tia or Thea, which was right?
Thea is the right one.
Thea, yeah. Gilmore, thank you very much indeed. Apologies for getting your name wrong earlier on, if I did. You're really young, and you're really talented, and I hate you for that.
I like you for saying really young.
Well, younger than me is really young. You are quite young. You've had about... Is it 15 albums you've had out?
I'm on my 15th, yeah.
That's showing off a bit, I think. Isn't it?
Yeah, probably, but you know.
You did start quite young, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I started making music when I was 17, so I've had a fair while to get them out, churn them out a bit.
Yeah, how are you finding it? It's a strange career to start at 17 and continue as a career, you know, to be able to maintain that career.
Yeah, it doesn't happen these days, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Two albums and you're out these days. But I was really obnoxious and kind of, sort of up myself when I was 17, and I thought I knew better than anybody. And so I thought, well, look, I'm going to release an album a year, and if the industry tells me not to, I'll just sort of say that they're wrong, which is exactly what I did. And, you know, actually, the industry industry probably wasn't wrong in some respects. It's a lot of records, but I've had fun, and you know, it's kept me fresh, and that's
and your
thing.
Audience, they're okay with. It's funny we're talking about this because I was. I don't know if you follow David Crosby on Twitter from Crosby, Stills and Nash.
Yeah,
isn't he wonderful?
He's brilliant.
He'll answer any question. I questioned him yesterday if there was a bare knuckle fight between him, Stephen Stills, and Graham Nash, who'd win? He answered it. He said he'd win, of course.
That's what I would have said too, to be fair.
But someone was asking him that Neil Young has released 3 albums in the last 14 months. And that seems a bit like, do your fans ever message you on Twitter or Facebook and go, oh, for goodness sakes, please, just give us a break. We can't afford this anymore.
They are so amazing.
Really?
The people who follow my music, I've got such a lot to thank them for, actually. No, they will literally support me in pretty much whatever I do. And you can't make careers like that anymore. They don't exist.
Reading up on you, I got the impression that with your the fans, your audience, it is kind of a community, isn't it? It feels like there's a kind of a community around you.
Very much so, yeah. And I sort of feel like you know, the modern music, that makes me sound really old, doesn't it?
That thing I said earlier about you being young,
yeah,
I take
yeah,
it back
take
immediately.
It back, scrub that. But no, we're kind of designed these days not to connect with the person making the music. It's all about just the music as a product and then sell it and move on to the next thing. And I think that where I got it right was by communicating with them directly as people, and they could communicate directly with me as a person, and that way they kind of bought into the personality behind the music and not just the product.
It's that thing nowadays, if you don't have hit single, I don't even know what a single is anymore, but if your album doesn't sell, that's it, you're done. Whereas, you know, in the 60s and 70s, if your album didn't sell, okay, well, we'll try. You get like 3-4 albums to have a go before you kind of got the boot. No one seems to have the ability to grow anymore.
No.
And you obviously have with your career.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Every album that I release sells more than the last one. I mean, R.E.M., it took R.E.M. till their 8th album, I think, to actually make it, whatever that means. But no, we're not allowed to do that anymore. It's easier for industry, isn't it, to kind of have something that kind of turns over quickly.
Right, the new album, Ghosts and Graffiti, am I right, this is some new songs and some re-recorded versions of old stuff?
Yeah.
How did you get to work with Joan Baez? That was the one that struck out, you know, struck me as going, but Joan Baez?
Yeah, Joan Baez. Well, I've toured with Joan Baez a few years ago back in America, and I know her manager really well, and I know Joan quite well as well.
How cool is that? Oh, yeah, I know Joan quite well. That's brilliant.
I didn't think she'd do it, though, 'cause she's pretty busy, but she was kind of the top of my hit list.
When you say you know Joan quite well, if I were to steal your mobile phone and go to the Jays, would Joan Baez be in there?
I don't think anyone has Joan Baez's number apart from her manager.
That's still very cool, though.
Yeah, I know. I've got a remote.
Have you got a remote? And Billy Bragg as well.
Yeah.
Billy Bragg.
He's amazing.
He is amazing. And is there that thing, though, how does it work? Do you write to them directly? Does your manager get in touch with their manager? How does that kind of get set up?
I don't have a manager.
Dear.
No, managers are boring. No.
Wow.
No, I do it directly. I know Billy a little bit, and I've performed on his Left Field stage at Glastonbury. Yeah. We know each other a bit. So I've got his email address. I've got his phone number. I just sent him a text and said, are you up for it? Billy Bragg is the most down-to-earth man. He's the nicest person. And he was just like, yeah, of course.
I'm grinning like a 15-year-old here because you're just like me. You're so cool. Yeah, I know John. I know Billy. The single, we're going to play the single now while you kind of set up. We're going to play the single from the compact disc, and then you're going to set up and play something. Coming back to you, is there anything I should know about it?
It's a grown-up love song. You know, people don't write those very much, but it's a grown-up love song about how you kind of have to work at it.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to this. Hang on a second. Hang on. Yeah, this should do it. Here we go. If I press the play button. Oh, dearie me, hang on. Ooh, there we go. Now, I'd like to say that sounded excellent, but you saw me, Thea. I couldn't listen at all. We were trying to set up the studio, so I'm sure it sounded excellent.
Thank you.
That sounded really rude. What I meant was I was distracted.
That's
as you
fine.
Saw.
I could see the beads of sweat on your face. You were working.
I've got no idea what these buttons or what these knobs do. You're just coming to the end of a tour, aren't you?
Yes.
How has that gone?
It's been brilliant. It's gone really fast, actually.
Really?
Yeah, but we're finishing off in London.
How often do you tour? Do you do it every year? Is it every 6 months? What's kind of the deal?
A couple of times a year, really. Yeah, I just like it. And it's a great way of being directly in communication with your fans.
And there's 3 of you here now. We've got the violin, we've got 2 guitars. Is that the band that goes, or do you have the full works?
No, we've got 9 people on stage tonight with us.
Flippin' heck.
Yeah.
Well, who, what? Where are these slackers? Why are they not bothered turning up?
Well,
what's going on?
We might struggle to squeeze a full kit and a string quartet in here, but...
Is there a string quartet?
Well, there's 2, actually.
Well, that's a string duet. That's, well, you've doubled it.
Technically, there are 4 string players, actually, but, you know.
to Cadogan Hall you're playing
That's
tonight.
Right, yeah.
And is the I imagine the kind of the last night of a tour is a little bit looser, a little bit more celebratory than the not saying you've sold everybody short who's been to see you so far, but it's kind of like end of term vibe, I'd imagine,
every
is there?
Every night's a celebration.
You're gonna play live for us.
Yeah, indeed.
What are you gonna play for us?
We're gonna celebrate your station and play a song called London.
Oh, there we go. All right, listen, away you go. Take it away.
One, two, three, four.
Oh, yes, we'll have some of that. That was good. That was fantastic. Thank you for that.
Cheers.
I hope I oh, we turn it off, otherwise we sound like we're in a cave. I think I managed to mix that well enough. As I say, sure. I'm no Brian Wilson or Phil Spector, but I think we got that. You're playing Cadogan Hall tonight. Any tickets left?
There are a few, I believe, so please do come along.
And I'm assuming there's websites and things as well that people can find out more.
Yeah, TheaGilmore.net is the website. I'm on Twitter at TheaGilmore.
Are you one of those people that's accessible to, you know, if someone sends an email to the website, you're going to reply to
totally,
it?
Totally, yeah, it comes straight to me.
Do you get some weird stuff, though?
Yeah.
It sounds like you enjoy the weird stuff.
I do quite like it, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, when we say weird, I mean, like, you know, kinky stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay, yeah. Blimey, I'll send you an email later on. The album, Ghosts and Graffiti, from Fulfill Records, I'm assuming you can get it on, you get it all the usual places.
You can get it everywhere, yeah.
Our price and all of that kind
yes,
of.
Yes, that's right.
It's so nice to meet you, so nice to meet all of you. Thank you
too.
Very much, it sounded absolutely brilliant.
Cheers.
We're going to have a little bit of, oh, where are we now? Let's have a bit of this. One of the joys of sitting in for Robert Elms is, A, I get to see talented young people like Joe Good, and then we get our guests like that. No, is we get talented, beautiful young people, Joe.
Thank you.
They make me sick. They make me sick.
Yeah, but you know, everyone has a shelf life, so I can speak from authority on that. So anyway, I have the lights dim when I come in here, so people only ever see me in silhouette.
All right, so Joe and I bump into each other, what, like every 6 months,
yes.
8 months, something
in
like
fact,
that.
Philip from South Norwood said, oh, he emailed gosh. Me to say, can you thank Ian for allowing me to talk up the barking hour on your radio show on
I do a gig on another station, and he keeps phoning up plugging you, for crying out
thank
loud.
You.
Does he not know the
so
rules?
Loyal, our listeners.
I'm sorry that Philip's landing on your doorstep.
No.
Joe, it's lovely to see you. What's on the show today?
So, I was to say Carol Spinney, does that mean anything to you?
Oh, it does. Why does it?
Big Bird from Sesame Street.
Oh, yes!
And the documentary. So,
I'm looking forward to seeing the documentary.
Well, yeah. He's going to come on the show. He's going to be, obviously, on the phone because he's doing
Is he coming
States.
On the show?
He's coming on the show,
Oh,
yes.
I myself am deeply envious.
And,
wow.
And the documentary is very, very emotional yeah. because they always say, as an actress, my agent used to say to me, never do skin work. But it's very interesting. Sorry. When you're yes exactly and we'll gloss over that it's very interesting when you're in the skin looking out
yeah,
so to speak
yeah.
So he you know is there making children laugh and everything but he's the guy in and seeing life from his perspective but also his story is really really interesting mm. So
he was going to go up into space
he was
in the Big Bird
right.
costume
and then NASA pulled it back at the last moment he was gosh you know your stuff
oh no
so
it's
anyway
a great
that
story.
Documentary I Am Big Bird is out and we're going to be talking to Carol Spinney and before that have you ever had braids have you ever did you ever have a ponytail?
Yes.
There is a braid bar. Please, can you put pictures on Facebook?
No.
Did
no,
you
no,
let,
no.
Please say you only had one. You didn't have two like Heidi.
Oh, no, I only had one. What do you think I was?
That.
Goodness sakes.
You with two plaits and a cummerbund. Oh, in my dreams.
You'd love it, wouldn't you?
Anyway, there is a braid bar in Selfridges and we're going to take you there.
Fantastic.
You,
Joe, it's so nice to see you.
Thank
have
you.
Fun.
Lovely.
Big Bird is on the show. Hey, guys, listen, that's it. That's your lot from me. Robert Elms will be back tomorrow. Thank you, production team, for making me sound halfway decent. And thank you for all of your calls and your texts and your emails. It's much appreciated.